Hi everyone, I just went to a session with the chair of the final exam and I thought I'd take this opportunity to do a very impromptu recording and just ask all those hard questions we want to know about this exam. Really apologize for the quality of the recording, it's just done on my iPhone, but hopefully this is good enough and has just a lot of useful information. So here we go. Hi everyone, welcome to the ABCs of Anesthesia podcast. I'm really, really fortunate. I'm here at the ANSCA ASM in Brisbane. I've got with me Dr. Anthony Corot. Anthony, he's an anaesthetist in Queensland. He's a chair of the final exam, so really, really relevant for, I guess, everyone who's sitting, about to sit the final exam or about to go through the actual process of studying for it. And not only that, Anthony, so you were the dual prize winner, the Douglas Renton Prize and the Cecil Bury Prize. That seems like a little bit of overachieving to me.
That was a full generation to go back. So.
Now, you've been an examiner since 2012, and you obviously come from really good pedigree because you passed, you know, both exams really well. Actually, just the thought comes to me, did you, when you were studying for the exam, did you know that you were good at exams, and did you know that you would do pretty well in this? Like, did you get
no,
that sense?
No, I was concerned about the exam and how I would be prepared, and I'm a person who doesn't like to have things half-answered, if you know what I mean. So, actually, the first time I sat, when I sat the primary, I was studying with a group and they all sat and I thought, well, you all know less than me and I think I'm woefully underprepared. And then they all passed.
Yeah.
And I realised that probably if I sat then I might have passed. So I just kept studying and then obviously got a good result in the primary. And then with the second part, I was with a group and I studied hard but had a lot of other things happening at the time. We were having our first child, my wife and I, and so yeah, it was a busy time in our lives, but I suppose my technique, I think, is probably good. My approach to how I think about exams is probably good, and I think it still is that. And I think a bit of that is, that's a significant factor. You've got to have the knowledge. It's a bit like when you're working. You have knowledge, and then you have the way you apply the knowledge. And I think my thought systems about applying the knowledge serve me in good practice for the exam, and I actually think they serve me in good practice for work, because
okay.
I think that's a good foundation.
I remember when I was in high school, my mum would tell me advice like, just put lots and lots of information on the page and they can't fail you. And that's the way I actually approached most of my exams. It went well in high school. It went okay. I passed the primary exam, but I remember thinking how disappointed my colleagues were, my bosses were, when I answered questions without structure. It's like, this is what my mum taught me back when I was 10 years old, and it didn't quite hit, but I changed it up for the final exam and it did well for me.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's the amount of information you put down is not as important as putting down the most important pieces of information. And so judgment's a huge factor that we're trying to assess in our exams. So minutiae of knowledge is good, but it doesn't correlate to anything like clinically that you can say, well, this is about safe practice. Whereas a structured answer sort of implies that there's a systematic approach to dealing with a problem.
Yeah.
And we like that. That makes us all feel good. And it makes, I think it makes your work environment good too. I imagine nearly everyone who's listening to your podcast, when they go to work, it's not a haphazard approach to work where it'd be way too stressful. You have a bit of structure about how you organise your day and how you organise your pento tray even. It's the same sort of thing. Those sort of good, clean habits make for better anaesthesia, and I think they make for better exam process.
Yeah, good, okay. Now, in your talk, again, really useful because it's, from the horse's mouth, this is what we're looking for in a lot of the traps. And I remember just writing down a couple of the notes where you had a slide of what hurts, poor handwriting, material that doesn't answer the question asked, inaccurate or incorrect information, that's obvious, information that's poorly organised, that we'll allude to, overemphasis on minutiae, lack of knowledge and content, lack of important specifics like drug doses and target ranges, and no balance between motherhood statements and minutiae. I think that's a really good summary of things, but I thought I might ask you some particular questions and maybe go back into those things as well.
Yeah.
The person was a medical advisor. Now, there wasn't there was a communication about it, but essentially the medical advisors, there's no change to next sittings. It's just that there's a WBA that's additional but not part of the...
Yeah, so I suppose there was a bit of, miscommunication or poorly worded communication around this that came out, and it's a shame because I'll explain the situation pretty clearly.
Mm.
So prior to COVID, so that's up to 2019.2, we had medical drivers that were with patients. They were very non-standardised because obviously every patient was different, and it was very, very difficult, therefore, to say that everyone had had the same or relatively similar experiences in the exam. And I always had a problem with this, as did many examiners, and we were always trying to get a better system. And we tried a whole heap of different things with rubrics because we actually thought that the clinical interaction was still a very important part of the exam, and we still do. COVID sort of changed all that because we just couldn't have patients, and that actually gave us, you know, it's like the silver lining on every cloud. It gave us the impetus to create a new medical viva, which we have had basically since 2021. We try and produce the same two medical vivas for the whole cohort. We are sometimes limited by venues and the size of the venues, and so sometimes we have four medical vivas and half the cohort will do two and the other half of the cohort will do the other two. But in general, our preferred model, if we can get a sufficiently sized venue, and that's hard because there's a lot of candidates these days, but if we can get the venue size right, two medical vivas, and those two vivas are identical.
Yeah.
So not identical. Each person gets the identical experience, right, in those
one
vivas.
One cardiorespiratory and one other.
And that's correct. Yeah. So and we guarantee that one of the vivas will always be cardiorespiratory, but the other viva may be cardiorespiratory, but maybe on another clinical system, whether that's gastrointestinal, multisystem disease, neurology, all things that are important that you'll come across every day. Our viva is pitched at the level of a preoperative consultation with a complicated patient. And what we want from the medical viva, what we want to see, is focused history and examination. So if it's a cardiac history, you want the questions to relate to cardiac symptoms and symptoms that might be more important with that condition. So if you're told the patient's got aortic stenosis, then, you know, presyncope is a big thing.
Yes.
Shortness of breath is a big thing. Chest pain is a big thing. You know? So history that's focused around that, as well as the other history you might take from a medical patient.
Yeah.
And then the examination similarly.
Actually, with the examination, is it safe to just go straight for the Talia Connor style? I'm looking at the hands, fingernails. Would you want any of that minutiae?
I think that we would say the usual question would be, you now move to examination patient. What signs would you be looking for to confirm your diagnosis or to help you further elucidate the severity of this patient's problems? And so it might be that you ask about clubbing and certainly say if you had someone who had a aortic stenosis, feeling the pulse quality is actually important because a small volume pulse is significant. So I would expect that.
Yes.
But we also would expect to hear about the murmur, where it might radiate, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And
you'd almost say Janeway's lesions, Osler's nose, all that infective endocarditis, that is not something we need to referee.
Well, only if I suppose you could have a cardiorespiratory case where a patient has infective endocarditis. That's a possibility. And if that was the case, I would expect.
But not for aortic stenosis.
But not for, if you said, oh, I'm really interested in that for an aortic stenosis fiber, you're sort of going off the track and down the garden path a little bit. You need to stay focused on what the condition is you're trying to assess. If the examiner feels that you need to go down that path, they'll encourage you back to that. But if you stay on the things that are mainstream about the condition you're looking at, then you will be doing your best in the viva. The viva is not set up as a trick, so there's no special keys you've got to do to open the door. Everyone progresses through the viva through a set number of steps. The only thing that stops you progressing through the viva is if you can't answer the question, and we have to come at it in a different way, because then the more ways we have to ask the question, the sort of longer it takes to get you to the next step in the viva.
That makes sense. So the medical viva, therefore, will not have a patient. It will stay the same as it has been, the extra thing is the WBA with patient contact.
Yeah, so the clinical context got lost with that COVID thing. I got off track, my apologies. We believe, and the college, when I say we, I mean the Court of Examiners believe, and the college believe, that that is actually still an important aspect of that we would like to we would like, you know, specialists to have some idea about how to examine a patient. And so there was a project to create a assessment item that would assess that. It struck a few hurdles in terms of the delivery of it and how it could be incorporated into the curriculum without increasing workload. And so it's been through a few reiterations, and I think it's still being reiterated, but I'm hopeful that start of next year it will go live. And it's not meant to be a punitive exercise for trainees. It's meant to be like, you know, it's almost like a more simple demonstration that you have some clinical skills, which you should have, and, you know, even as a basic trainee, to do your job properly. So it's not like it's going to be, we're not asking for a complete perioperative assessment of a patient at the level of a perioperative physician. You know, the standard for our exam is a first-year consultant in independent practice, and no matter what the question is, that's what the standard is marked to.
Yeah, okay. The next question that came up in our chat was, are SAQs and MCQ marks scaled, and if so, how?
So SAQ marks aren't scaled, but they're standard set. MCQ marks are scaled as part of a standard setting process. So every section of the final exam has standard setting. MCQ in all sections of the exam, our standard setting is what we call criteria reference. So it is the cumulative, it's the cumulative standard of the Court of Examiners that you're being assessed against.
Yes.
So MCQs go through a process called EBEL transformation. So what happens is the MCQ exam is distributed to a subgroup of examiners. That subgroup is from a wide section of the court. So we get geographic representation, so we across both countries and all regions. We get equal gender representation. We have subspecialty representation, so all different subspecialty groups. So it's not all being asked by cardiac kinesis or being assessed by cardiac kinesis, say. I'm not calling cardiac kinesis out, we have different levels of experience of examiners, so from junior to more senior examiners, and also different levels of experience clinically, because some of our examiners come to examining 5 years after they finish their fellowship, and others come 15 years later. And so there's a whole range of ages of anaesthetists who are involved as well. So, and which changes your viewpoint of a lot of issues. They do the whole exam just like candidates do the exam, all 150 questions, and they scale the questions for difficulty and for applicability on a scale. And that difficulty and applicability score is put into a matrix, and from that we generate a cut score, which is the score where around about where 50% of, like, you know, it's the 50% mark.
Yeah, and just to clarify, so with that scaling question that the audience has asked, everyone could theoretically pass the SAQ, and everyone could theoretically pass the MCQ if they achieve the standard.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's yes. Right.
Yeah. And your standard setting is to give a good range of easy, hard, applicable, less applicable.
Well, we mark from, you know, the exam's a score between 0 and 100, your final result. So we have to ask questions that enable us to differentiate between all those different levels.
Yeah.
Practically, in an MCQ exam, you can't get less than 20% if you answer all the questions, you know, by chance. And so what we do once we get the cut score is we then scale the marks from that 20% mark up, and that enables us to save, and it's pretty consistent that the pass mark for the exam sits around about, it's about 98 to 102 questions out of 150, and the 40% mark, which is the cutoff for getting asked to the vivas, usually sits somewhere between about 86 and 88 questions out of 150.
Okay, good to know. Can I then ask, in the SAQ and the Viva, is the marking guide such that they are, you know, it's literally like a tick box of some sort where, for this question, these things must be said, tick, 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 that equals marks, equals pass, equals something? Or is it more of an impression and a vibe?
So there is a set of minimum criteria that have to be achieved. It's not so much a tick box exercise. So you don't get a point for saying the blood pressure should be this and the dose should be that and the dose should be this. And once you get 5 tick boxes, you've passed the question. The marking is more global than that. Yep. So it's about the, because it's about the integrated experience. It's a exam that's based in a clinical setting. And so for the, especially for the providers, there's got to be an understanding that there's a decision that might be made. And so some elements of the questioning will be more important than other elements of the questioning in terms of delineating where a candidate is at achieving the standard. But some of the other questions might, like there's more granular points, might help certainly increase your score once you've reached the standard to get a higher mark.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think so. To reiterate, there isn't a it's not that you have to say specific words or facts or data, but it's an overall answer to a question.
Yes. But we are looking for certain achievements in assessment and in the answer. So we are looking for certain items.
Yeah.
But it's not just the items, it's the integration of the items and that they're in the appropriate order. So if there was, say we're talking about 4 causes of raised temperature, and in a situation like, you know, say a patient's got a sepsis and they're febrile, the first thing you think is the patient's septic. But if the first thing you say is the patient's got malignant hyperthermia and sepsis doesn't appear in the differential diagnosis, well, you're probably not going to do that well.
That's right. So even though you've said the word, because you haven't said the prioritised answer to it, won't mark as high.
It won't mark as high, yeah. Okay. So it's not just, it's showing an understanding of what is on. And I say this often when people are writing exam answers, and especially when you're marking SAQs, I'm often marking SAQs and there'll be 6 pages of writing and 4.5 pages of the writing have nothing to do with the question or are all just, they're of no value in scoring the candidate marks. To achieve the minimum criteria for most questions, there's usually 3 or 4, sometimes it's 5, but usually some pretty basic concepts that just have to be acknowledged or explained, depending on the type of question is and what's being asked. And we need to see that in the SAQs to give those marks. And that sometimes, sometimes the questions will have lists, and it'll be listed, and if that's the case, you can just write those items. But if a question says discuss, then you can't just write the item. You've got to write what the item is and how it answers the question. And that comes back to reading the question, which I think we'll probably end up talking about a bit.
Just to quickly brush on motherhood statements, I remember you mentioned in there too. So saying things like safety of the patient is of paramount concern, pretty much a useless thing to say, because and may attract a negative feeling or sentiment or negative mark in a sense.
They don't attract a negative mark, but I think they stop you from, your time's limited. The Viva is a time limited exercise, and the SAQ is a time limited exercise. So a definition is a useful statement, and a statement that maybe gives an overall principle is a useful statement. But if you're talking about a shocked patient and you say hypertension is bad and we want to avoid it, that's sort of broad, almost prime, like my children could probably say that, if you know what I mean. Those sorts of statements, they don't help you, and we try not to have bias in what we do, but those sorts of a statement that doesn't add much and it almost looks like you're afraid of the answer, it doesn't help you score well. It creates this perception of they're not focused. Because we're talking about, we want you to write the answer for the question, and that isn't contributing. And it's a bit like I said, a lot of waffle on the page. So if there's a lot of stuff on the page that isn't relevant to the question, we can't give you marks for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, and just to clarify, you know, motherhood statements aren't adding any extra information, but a summary statement of, you know, hypertension, this patient with severe atherosclerotic disease, this is particularly, this is a critical issue in this patient, and then go on to summary statement of issues.
So that's a completely different scenario, because there you've shown, I've taken the piece of information that they've got ischemic heart disease, the piece of information that they've got hypotension, and I've said, this is a critical situation, I've made a value judgment, and I'm prioritising the care of that over maybe some other competing interest that's have been identified. And we often ask questions where there are competing interests, and sometimes we ask questions where there's competing interests and there's no correct answer, but we want to check that the process that you go through has a justification, and that you recognise that the issues are competing, and that you know that if you're doing one thing, you might be risking another, and you might have a plan to manage the complication that you're anticipating coming.
And anyone who's done the Viva course, that, you know, that phrase of appreciating the risks, so you've got two conflicting things, you just say, you know, appreciating the risks of that problem, I'm doing this problem, and this is what I'm going to fix
That's a good answer. That's the sort of high-level functioning, and that's what you do clinically.
It's damned if you do, damned if you don't, but you've got to do something.
But you've got to do something. Well, you do have to do something. I often talk about this. Sometimes people there's a bit of a mindset that candidates seem to think that we'll create these tricky situations in the vivas if you say the wrong thing. I always say to people, the vivas are going to happen no matter what. At the end of the day, we can't assess you unless things happen in the viva. Stick away from answering the question, the viva can't progress and you can't get assessed. You've got to let it happen. That doesn't mean you need to cause bad things to happen. That's a completely different issue. Yeah. But you need to answer and say what you would do, and then the viva happens. If the viva happens and the patient's getting sicker and worse and things are happening, that's part of the viva. That's not necessarily you.
Yeah.
You know, if you've made a mistake and that's hurt a patient, you're more likely to get asked the question about, oh, I just wanted to check those drug doses, or I just want to, can you just explain that to me again? And whenever you get like a feedback cue like that, I think it's always important to think very carefully about what you've said and make sure that you actually do say what you believe and what you would do.
This is, I guess, the spectrum of the "Are you sure?" question. It's a clear indication that, hey, something may be a little bit off. Just clarify that for me. Well, and explain your reason.
Yeah, and it might have been. It might be that you said it a bit softly too, and we couldn't quite hear you. That happens.
Yeah.
But even then, that's a good opportunity to just say, okay, I'm just going to take a second. I'm going to think about my answer and make sure I say exactly what I think.
Yeah, excellent.
And that's a good strategy.
Yeah, good. Is there any marking for sounding consultant-like? It's a pretty random question, but I definitely, as I was practicing, my colleague who's phenomenal at this exam, every time he was telling me, you don't sound like a consultant, you've got to sound more confident or something. Is there something about that?
I don't know if saying sounding consultant-like maybe is the right description of it. So we're looking for people, when you pass the exam, you've got to demonstrate that you're considering the issues, making a judgment and making a decision.
Okay, and that's consultant-like.
And that's consultant-like behaviour. So it's not that you sound like a consultant, it's that you behave like a consultant, that you consider the pluses and the minuses of all the different options you've got ahead of you, and then you deliver a path through that is half of best fit, I suppose.
Exactly.
One of the better.
Imagine being decisive and confident with a loud voice and saying ridiculous things. That's a clear fail. You sound like a consultant, but the content there is inaccurate.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't have to sort of come across the table and be in their face to say that. But you do. It helps if you can speak up in the exam. It's really noisy, and some of the examiners like me are getting a bit old. Careful what I say, but it is helpful if people do speak up. It's nice to hear, but an aggressive approach to things doesn't necessarily help you It's what you're saying and demonstrating how you think that's going to help you.
Good. I find that in the exams, often there's a broad question or a specific question. Like in the example I've got here, let's say a specific question would be, you know, what parts of the thyroid mass are you most concerned about? And you might say AON, which would be compromising, mediastinal shift, or something like that. But if someone said, if the question was, what do you want to know on assessment of this patient, would you encourage, again, a very targeted approach to go for exactly what you want to know? But using as a quick statement like, aside from the usual anesthetic assessment, I'm really concerned about a mass effect malignancy.
Yeah, I think you say focusing on the problem at hand, I would be looking for this and this. In addition to that, I would like to know my usual anesthetic thing, the examiner will be looking at this and thinking, okay, so they understand all the issues that I'm worried about that problem. Yes, I know they're worried. They're happy with that. That's good. And they'll just pull you up and say, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, great.
If you really struggled to identify what the important issues were with the thyroid mass, they might ask you a bit more about the other stuff you're saying, trying to work out if the issue is that you didn't recognise that the thyroid mass was a problem, or if you thought, or if you said something that was a little bit unusual, say in the other section, and then they think, oh well, I've really got to explore that now that you've said it, because that sometimes does happen.
Okay. It's similarly, let's say you're asked, how do you do a supraclavicular nerve block, and in my mind, that's about the technique of the nerve block. To say from with my usual setup and consent, I would then do this approach, this equipment, this.
Yeah. So I think that's that sort of thing. You do need to mention those issues, consent and appropriate equipment, but you can
quickly cover that.
You
with
can
a
quickly
word.
Cover that with like three or four words. You can say, I would have my assistant proper equipment that I'm familiar with, whether you're using an ultrasound or nerve stimuli technique, and I'd certainly have consent from the patient.
Yeah.
And then my anatomical technique is to do this.
Correct. And if the examiner wanted more detail about any consent issue or equipment, then that's the viva.
I don't think that's wasting time in the viva. That's you're being asked, how do you do this? And that is actually important parts of that process.
Yeah.
Whereas if the question was something about, say we're talking about that block question, but the question was, what is the dosing and drugs? What are the dose and drug of Rapivacaine you'd use for your supraclavicular block, and you started off with, oh, my usual approach is to do this and consent. Well, that's not the question you were asked, and so whilst you're saying it, you're not generating any points in your block. You're not covering off things that we need to get covered in the viva, we've then got to say, okay, so but what we're redirecting you to move you forward, and you've lost time, and you have 15 minutes. It seems like an eternity when you're in the viva, but once you've finished it, you think, oh, geez, I wish I had two more minutes. I could have actually explained that properly. Yeah, I mean, time is really, it's your enemy and your friend.
Yeah, that's good. I had a question about, say, these broad questions that you might get asked in the SAQ and the viva. I found that with the SAQ, there's no examiner there. So, say, you ask about all the perioperative issues of something, I have a framework of, pre, intra, post, and that whole thing of, have a framework of consent, optimize, pre-med, explain, and then highlight within that the critical points in each thing. So would you say that to actually write out that framework in a complete fashion, highlight all the most important things, potentially the summary at the start, all within it, but then just start writing the important points of each of these elements, is that how you'd approach a broad, short answer question?
Yeah, that's how I approach a broad, short answer question. And certainly any short answer question with the word perioperative in it, you would definitely want to talk about, you want to get those headings on the page so you don't forget to write something about, because we've asked perioperative, which means we expect you to be talking about pre, intra and post-op.
Yes.
So you want to get those headings down the page so that you've got to write something in. Just writing perioperative or get you over the line. You've actually got to have something there. But then you've got time to think about the issues. And I would say try and get the issues you want to talk into those areas down first as little notes and then expand on it. And I find when you do that, you don't tend to maybe write as much, but what you write is better quality and much more focused. And so you're answer reads a heap better, and it's got structure and organization to it, and it's that consultant-like thinking that it influences your mark greatly, because it's we can now see that you understand the issues and that you've got an approach.
Yeah. And I guess the transition to the vibe would be similar. You get another broad question, and by saying preoperatively, I'm most concerned about this, this, and this, intro this and this, post this and this, in more detail, I would always get the whole detail down. Is that...
Yeah, so the vibe will be more specific than that. You would very rarely get a question that's that broad, very hard for us to assess decision points around that, and you end up with a lot of talking and a lot of wasted time for making assessment. So your Viva question would be slightly more focused than that, but it might be in one area. So you might get something about, so you'll be in maybe a pre or an intraoperative area, and you'll be, something will happen, and we'll say, so how would you approach the situation? And so say it was a hypoxia, you might talk about machine factors, circuit factors, patient factors, or whatever your algorithm is to work your way from either the machine to the patient or the patient machine to sort out the problem.
That's good. I wanted to ask you about specific scenarios and vivas and how these decisions get made. So I know that when I was first studying in our local anaesthetic, I guess, community, inhalational induction for an epiglottitis kids case is the way of doing it. But, in other parts of Australia, plenty of people doing rapid sequence inductions for RSI and tamponade wasn't the way to go. We were worried about positive pressure ventilation, so the spont vent tamponade induction was the way to go. Do you have a feeling of if there's right or wrong, or these are all actually open to discussion and open to...
Standard setting is really important in the Viva, and we spend a lot of time on this. So the process for Viva authoring is that when on the day of the writtens, the Viva stem, so the learning objectives we want covered and the situation we think that might be good to achieve those learning objectives is sent to the Viva authors. The Viva authors are all in groups of 20. And so there'll be 4 Viva authors and 16 other examiners. You do a collaborative writing of the Vivas. There's multiple drafts. Currently, I think one of the Vivas are up to draft number 6 that's going to be delivered in a few weeks' time. They're improved continuously, and they're improved against a wide variety, like I said, of clinical experience. So you won't get a pediatric Viva where the Viva was written exclusively by pediatric anaesthetists, because that actually implies that you'll end up with a standard that is much higher than the standard that is required to pass the exam.
Yeah.
We always keep in the forefront of our mind that when we're setting the exam, when we're setting the standard out of the question, it's what we would expect of a first-year consultant, not of a super specialised consultant. The case you might get told about might be super specialised, but the standard, and there might be things that happen there that are very uncomfortable for a first-year consultant, but the standard you're assessed about is what we think is the correct judgment for the correct level of knowledge and judgment for a first-year consultant.
Yeah.
Having said that, when you finish your exam, you have an enormous amount of knowledge, probably more knowledge than I have now. So that knowledge level is pretty high. The judgment, obviously, judgment's an experience factor. That's probably where we really notice the big changes.
Okay. And let's say there are these certain cases where, you've only got your experience of your immediate tertiary hospital, or even if you're out in the country in a different training scheme, that your immediate consultants around you. How does a trainee get a sense of what is an okay answer? If there are any hard or fast, I used to think I wouldn't do a spinal for a severe aortic stenosis, but I know that I do it plenty of times safely now, and it's not a big issue. But is there ever going to be a time where that's so it's difficult to know, and that's a fail point because of
the reason you would fail a Viva is not because you it's not necessarily what you would do, it's that you've done something that's going to hurt the patient. You've really to get a three all those, like the safety breach, you have to have made a mistake that is going to cause patient harm. So let's say, for example, a shock patient and you have to induce them for anaesthesia. If you give your normal induction dose that you would give to a 16-year-old having their wisdom teeth out,
that's a lot.
That's you know where that's going.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of issue where we find that there's, you know, that's a clear safety breach. We can't do anything about that. We can't recheck the dose, obviously, because you could just misspeak it, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And if you do that, like if you say the wrong thing, we say, oh, yeah, can you just go through that dose again with us? And you say the correct dose, then we say, oh, that's okay. That was just a misspeak.
Yes.
You don't get punished for that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so you don't do badly for that, but if you say that and then you double down on your dose and then you're at risk there of not doing well in that particular viva.
Yes,
Is that sort of what you're after?
Where
there's controversies in practice, that's usually very well documented in the viva writing process, because we have such a wide variety of people writing the vivas, and that's what's so important about standard setting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of educational literature that's critical of high stakes examination. There's a lot that's supportive of it too, but there's a lot that's critical of it, and they say, you know, about this moment in time factor and all that. But one of the things that they all say is that one of the power of these sorts of exams is really dramatically increased if you have multiple sources of it, you know, so that what you're standard setting against is a well-defined standard.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been working really hard over the last, the entire time I've been in the court. This is my 13th year examining. I think the standard that we assess to now in terms of the documentation of it is the best it's ever been.
Yeah.
So it's been a continuous improvement process, which is good. That's what we want to do.
I think I've definitely noticed that. Just the feedback form, the final exam reports, and it's very reassuring and very good as well. Anthony, so that is 36 minutes. That's probably 6 minutes over.
That's fine.
Yeah, no, that's thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
I'll send this out to everyone. Please share with anyone who might be interested. Always really great to get the chair of examiners there speaking about what it takes to pass this exam and a lot of the pitfalls and traps. And thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Cheers. Thanks for hearing.